The Hidden Forces podcast features long-form conversations broken into two parts, the second hour of which is made available to our premium subscribers, along with transcripts and notes to each conversation. For more information about how to access the episode overtimes, transcripts, and rundowns, head over to patreon.com/hiddenforces. You can also sign up to our mailing list at hiddenforces.io, follow us on Twitter at Hidden Forces Pod, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? My name is Dimitri Kofinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, a podcast that helps investors, entrepreneurs, and everyday citizens get an edge by equipping themselves with the knowledge needed to anticipate the challenges and opportunities of tomorrow. By sharing my critical thinking approach and by challenging consensus narratives about the power structures shaping our world, I help you make the connections to see the bigger picture, empowering you to make smarter decisions. On this week's episode, I speak with Karen Petru, co-founder and managing partner of Federal Financial Analytics, a consultant firm that provides analysis and advisory services on legislative, regulatory, and public policy issues. She is also the author of a new book titled Engine of Inequality, in which she argues that Fed policy is one of the primary drivers of wealth inequality in America and puts forward several solutions to fixing the problem, including a reversal of interest rate policy, balance sheet management, and forward guidance. We are living through the most extraordinary monetary experiment in U.S. financial history. If you'd graduated with a Ph.D. in monetary economics from Harvard in 2008, and someone dropped you into the middle of this week's FOMC meeting, you'd have absolutely no idea what was going on. That's how much monetary policy has changed in the intervening years, and how far the goalposts have moved from anything that would have been considered normal, and I would argue possible, in the world of money. My objective in bringing you this conversation today is to help you better understand not only how monetary policy and financial regulations have changed in the years since the great financial crisis, but also how those changes have destabilized society and impaired financial markets by transferring risk from the more tightly regulated banking sector, which was the source of the 08 panic, to other parts of the system. In the subscriber overtime, Karen and I discuss solutions to the current predicament and what would be needed in order to make those changes possible. We also discuss limits to the current policy and how much more room policymakers have to stimulate the economy before inflation finally begins to pick up, or before we start seeing yields in the Treasury market begin to rise precipitously. We may already be there. And with that, please enjoy this thought-provoking and important conversation with my guest, Karen Petru. Karen Petru, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Thank you, Dimitri.
It's great having you on the program.
It's a pleasure. It's a great program.
Thank you very much. So where do you live? Where are you located?
Washington, D.C.
How long have you been there?
A long time. I'm old. I've been here since 1979.
Wow. You've seen a lot of changes in D.C. I lived in D.C. between 2011 and 2013 in DuPont Circle.
Oh, that's not far from where I live. I live up right by Rock Creek Park.
Okay, cool. Yeah. It's a beautiful town. It's unique in many ways. You know, it really changed a lot after 9/11. With all of the spending by the Bush administration and subsequently, it feels in many ways like it's bursting at the seams. It doesn't have the infrastructure or capacity, both in the private and public sector, to really service the, well, public sector it does. It most certainly does, to service the needs of the people.
Yeah, it just keeps changing. I mean, now, of course, after the Capitol riots and the attack on January 6th, all of Capitol Hill is just a war zone. The city is a very different place but once you get over across town.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't considered that. So for people that aren't familiar with you, Karen, can you give my listeners a sense of your background and your journey and what brought you to the place you are today, where you are someone who talks about, thinks about, and writes about the Federal Reserve and issues like inequality?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I started my career a long time ago going to Wellesley College, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and then I was finishing a doctorate at the University of California at Berkeley in political science when I realized, I probably should have figured this out sooner, but I realized looking around the faculty where there were 40 or 45 men and one woman adjunct lecturer, that maybe academic life might not be a recipe, you know, a swift path to success for a woman. And at the same time, I interestingly was offered a position as a the only political scientist looking particularly at financial political risk affecting countries at Bank of America. So I thought, I don't know anything about banking, but I know a little bit about political risk. That sounds interesting, and it might pay some more. So sure, I'll give it a try. And I joined Bank of America, and I got quickly caught up, just because of the issues at the time, in questions of regulatory policy and monetary. What does the Fed do? What do banks do? What are the rules, and how do the rules change the way banks work? And the banks as a regulated business are deeply, directly, strategically affected by political decisions. So it really was very interesting to me. The bank moved me to Washington, and I represented the bank in this town before the regulatory agencies and Congress. And then in 1985, I had moved up through the ranks of the bank very fast. But the then CEO of the bank said he didn't feel good about making a young woman a senior vice president. And I hoped to get older, but I was not going to stop being female. So I started my own company, which we now call Federal Financial Analytics. And that's what I've been doing ever since, working with large financial institutions, central banks, U.S. regulators, investors, understanding how financial institutions work, and most importantly, how political and regulatory and monetary decisions change the way the financial system functions. I've looked at this over the years, really in terms of who wins and loses in terms of profits. What kind of activities should banks get in and out of? If an investor buys a bank, how much money is it likely to make? Those are the kinds of questions I looked at. But after the 2008 financial crisis, which really changed all of the rules, it became quickly clear to me, starting in 2011, when I wrote some papers on our own for ourselves, not for clients, about how the financial system was changing, that reforms, we needed reforms. The financial system, obviously, the crash in 2008 was cataclysmic with tremendous macroeconomic damage. But I thought some of the intersection between monetary and regulatory policy was going to lead to unintended consequences. And then 2015 and 2016, it became clear as I worked on the intersection of those unintended consequences in complicated areas like liquidity risk management and how the government securities bond market works in those areas, that there was another really serious issue, which was economic inequality. That the rules combined with monetary policy were changing the way the financial system worked. And that those changes not only made the financial system as a whole more fragile, but also America a lot less equal. And that's when I started thinking about these issues. And then as the 2016 election came along, it seemed to me that America was not only getting a lot more unequal and the financial system more fragile, but Americans were getting a lot angrier. That was a very visceral, vicious election. And what struck me was, you know, Hillary Clinton ran on the position of the Fed and the Obama administration, which was that the economy was in what the Fed likes to call a, quote, good place. That the recovery, the Obama administration, Democrats had brought the country out of from the crisis, out from the crash, and the country was in pretty good economic shape. And a lot of voters, especially African Americans, stayed home because the place they were in wasn't good. And Donald Trump said, you know, this place isn't good, not if you're a high school educated white man, not if you're a couple that used to have one worker in the household, now you need two, that used to work full time, now you're holding down two or three part-time jobs. You know, the economy isn't a good place. And he was right. For low, moderate, and middle-income households in 2016, the economy wasn't working well. It wasn't a good place. And the anger and the destruction that wrought really is what led me to write my book. This has to change. Financial policy is complicated, and nobody really thinks about it when you talk about equality. But the fuel, the engine of inequality, is money. And so you have to think about money, and that's why I wrote my book. Nights and Weekends.
You should have called it Nights and Weekends. The Fed. No, Nights
the
and...
book is called.
Yeah,
Engine
I know.
Of Inequality.
I know. I know. You should have called it Nights and Weekends at the Fed. So take me back to when you began your career. You said that B of A hired you as a political risk analyst.
That's right.
Did I hear that right? But you weren't qualified to do that. Did you say that you didn't?
No. I like to think I was.
Okay. I thought you said something to the contrary. So when was that? Can you give me a time frame? Are we talking about mid-1970s here?
You were talking 1977. I was qualified to do that. But what happened was the chairman of the board of the bank was called to testify before Congress, and they were on a question of international financial security. And so they said, we need somebody to write this testimony for him. And I said, I don't know anything about banking, but I do know about international financial security. And they said, well, somebody will write the banking parts. You just write the testimony. And I did. And he went to Washington and he thought it went very well. So I got promoted.
Well, it's interesting because the 1970s was the textbook period for not just regime change in markets, but political instability, both domestically and geopolitically, with the oil shock, with Nixon, with Ford. The end of Bretton Woods in the early 1970s led to a dramatic transformation of international capital flows and foreign exchange markets. And that speaks to your point about regulation and how regulation, I mean, Bretton Woods shaped the international monetary system. I'm curious how much that experience informs or you pull from today when you look at how the system is changing as a result of 2008 and the regulatory changes that went into effect after that?
Well, the system is so different, Dimitri, that the rigor and the understanding that in a regulated business, rules are strategic events has carried my thinking through from that day to now. And that might sound obvious, but it wasn't then and it still isn't where people think, you know, banks make money based on brilliant CEOs or that decision, you know, to move in, you know, to open branches in Texas. And all of that matters. But the be-all and end-all of a regulated industry is its rules. And particularly in a business where there are unregulated competitors with formidable resources, the rules really define winners and losers and also how safe or dangerous a financial market is to customers in terms of safe and sound banking, predatory lending, and to the economy as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. The reason, I mean, the thing that sort of comes to mind is how the banking system has changed, right? I mean,
Absolutely.
The end of Bretton Woods had an enormous effect on banking. And one could argue that, well, I don't know that I would be educated enough to compare the changes in the banking system post-2008 with those post-Bretton Woods, but certainly the banking system itself has dramatically changed. I mean, the way in which monetary policy is conducted and the way in which the Fed is able to influence credit in the economy is dramatically different today than it was before 2008, certainly before the end of Bretton Woods. I mean, that has sort of evolved over the years. So maybe the appropriate question to ask you, and this would be helpful for, I think, myself and especially for people that maybe aren't as familiar with monetary policy. How does monetary policy work? First of all, how did it work? Well, I first learned about monetary policy by reading William Grider's book, The Secrets of the Temple. And it's dramatically changed from that period under Volcker.
Oh, yeah.
Forget even 1913. So can you explain to people how monetary policy has traditionally worked and how it works today?
Sure. And I think it's important to know that your monetary policy works in the banking system and it works in the economy. Excuse me. So we've had a lot of things changing at the same time. One is the banking system. The basic mechanism of monetary policy used to be reserve requirements. Banks were required to hold a certain amount of money at the Fed in reserve based on how much people had in various transaction, checking, and savings accounts. And when the Fed wanted to tighten monetary policy, i.e. to make it more restrictive to slow the economy down, it raised those reserve requirements. So banks had to hold more at the Fed. They could put less into the economy and things slowed down. Conversely, when the Fed wanted accommodative policy, easy money, it reduced the reserve requirements. Banks had more money. They lent that out and the economy theoretically improved. The idea was very much that when the cost of money goes down, reserve requirements go down because banks now can lend more. Borrowers say, hey, that's cool. I'll go buy a car or a house. And the act of using that easy money stokes demand, which stokes employment, which stokes growth. And if you want to slow the economy down, you turn the knob in the other direction. Well, we had the S&L crisis in the 1980s. We had a banking crisis in the early 90s. And then we had the growth of non-bank organizations, particularly asset management companies. And bit by bit, banks became less and less important in the financial system. So the Fed went to plan B. It still had the reserve requirements, and it tried to set monetary policy through the reserve requirements, but it got more engaged in open market operations. The committee that sets policy at the Fed is called the Federal Open Market Committee. And the Fed went into what's called the Fed funds market and traded in that market also to raise or lower short-term rates as it thought best. And that worked relatively well, but the system was beginning to fray at the seams into the early 2000s when Alan Greenspan talked about the great moderation and he lowered interest rates and he said there would never be another financial crash. And it was fraying because banks were less important and therefore monetary policy working through the banking system worked less well. And because America was getting more and more unequal. In the 1970s, we had a very equal country. I mean, we had rich and poor people. But when I graduated from college in 1975, people earned their share of GDP, of national production. Rich people had more of it, but we all got an equal share. So poor people got the rewards of their labor, and middle-class households did quite well. In the last year for which data are available, 2018, the top 1% of Americans got 300% of the share that they got in 1975. Growth is distributed very differently in this country. And so the signals the Fed tried to send, stoking borrowing, which was then supposed to stoke demand and then stoke employment, don't work the way they did because rich people don't need new cars. They've got lots. They save their money instead. They do different things with their money than a middle class does. And without a middle class, monetary policy doesn't work. And we've seen that, particularly in the last 10 years.
So one of the things that you talk about in your book is that one of the issues that the Fed has had when it conducts monetary policy, sets interest rates, and tries to, quote, fine-tune the economy is that it's measuring its targets incorrectly. And you mentioned the Great Moderation and Alan Greenspan. How much was the Great Moderation simply an illusion or a manifestation of the imagination of policymakers who were measuring inflation in the wrong places and who were using the wrong indicators in order to determine economic growth, inflation, employment, et cetera?
I think the fundamental mistake that was made in the Great Moderation by Alan Greenspan that the Fed continues to this day is to think of prosperity in terms of the, quote, wealth effect. I call this trickle-down monetary policy. If you create more wealth, theoretically, you have a prosperous country because there is demand, there is employment. That wealth is going somewhere. But we've seen over the last decade in particular that we have a very powerful wealth effect. Rich people are getting very, very rich, but it's not generating strong economic growth. The recovery since 2010 is the weakest since the Second World War, and it's making America more and more unequal. It's a different economy in which a wealth effect backfires.
So walk me through that. How does Fed policy, and how has Fed policy as it's been conducted over the last, what, two decades? Do you begin the clock towards the end of the tech boom in the late 90s till today? How has Fed policy, in the way it's been conducted, driven inequality over this period? And tell me what period you are looking at.
Yeah, I'm really looking at the period from 2008 to today, because in the 2008 crisis, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed at the time, realized that the old approach to driving monetary policy through the banking system and also through the Fed funds market had blown up. It really wasn't working in the traditional way. So that's when he launched what is called unconventional monetary policy. And it does two things very differently than the Fed had ever done before. One, using the reserve tools, including some new ones, paying interest. The banks were holding reserves, but the Fed created incentive for banks to hold trillions in reserves at the Fed by paying them interest, created interest on excess reserves, and used those to drive rates, and it built a huge portfolio.
They moved from a corridor to a floor system.
That's correct, except the floor has always been rather soft, but that's tech. I was trying not to be technical, but technically
you are
correct.
Sure, for listeners who are interested, I know you were recently interviewed by George Selgin. He's written a book called Floored, where he discusses this, and we had him on the program as well. I think that was episode 128 or thereabouts, but go ahead.
Well, that's exactly right. And that policy, ultra-low interest rates, rates that since 2010 have been mostly below zero after taking inflation into account, very low real rates, and a huge Fed portfolio, changed the way the markets work. And they combined with the Fed's unwillingness to see any kind of market volatility. One of the points in my book is I really think the Fed has confused financial markets for the real economy. And it was so focused on financial market stability, it missed the fact that we didn't have shared prosperity or even strong economic growth for a few people. We had weak growth and inequality. But anybody who had money in the markets did very, very well. Anybody who tried to save by putting money in the bank lost money. That never used to happen. That's new. Savings used to be in the bank were supposed to be a good idea.
So I think it was Richard Koo that coined the phrase balance sheet recession,
right?
Where he certainly popularized it. How much is the phenomenon of a balance sheet driven recession, i.e. large outstanding amounts of private sector debt, how much of that is part and parcel of what you're describing when you talk about inequality? And how much does all of that fit into explaining why, as you mentioned, Bernanke saw that monetary policy as it was traditionally practiced didn't seem to generate the types of results that they were looking for. And so they went and they proceeded to change the operations in order to try and effect a different outcome.
Well, I think Richard Koo's theory is, I think, really important, but the Fed has never agreed with it. And so from Ben Bernanke's thinking, I don't think that entered into it, particularly in 2008, 2010, or for that matter, since. The Fed's approach to thinking about the economy has historically and really is, even though the Fed changed its monetary policy construct a little bit last year, the Fed's thinking is still very conventional. This much wage growth equals that much inflation, that sort of thinking, as opposed to understanding that when there is a significant amount of debt, private debt, as you said, people behave differently. Where I would refine Richard's model to look at debt distributionally, not just to look at the aggregate amounts of debt, but to see who has the debt. Because if you do that in the United States, and the US is very different than Japan or the Europe, you see that all but the top 10% have more debt than assets. This is a very indebted country. And so under any kind of stress, we have a significant amount of financial fragility.
Does that, if anything, only exacerbate the tendency for new money to push asset prices up in relation to consumer prices?
I think it does. Because where else would you, if you had excess savings, and the top 10%, particularly the top 1%, has a lot of savings, what are you going to do with it?
Right.
It's got to go somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think one way that people can think about this is that if you're wealthy enough and you don't, you have no marginal propensity to consume with additional income, and you're in an environment where money is free and there are concerns about inflation, well, then not only are you going to put your money, your incremental dollars into investments that you think are going to perform better in an inflationary environment, but you have no reason to sell them. Because if you sell them, what are you going to put them into? Cash? So this is kind of, it generates a Ponzi-like asset investment climate.
We see that. Look at Bitcoin. Look at these blank check companies that are, have $156 billion right now to spend on woohoo, anything.
Yeah, tech stocks, story stocks. And that, of course, goes back to your point about the wealth effect. This was in some ways a conscious decision by the Greenspan Fed, certainly after the 2001 9/11 attacks, to generate, certainly in the housing market, a wealth effect that could help drive the economy.
Oh, that's right. And you may recall that Alan Greenspan said there was no risk to that because the U.S. housing market could never fail.
Nationally,
he said,
yeah.
Nationally, he said, we might have regional housing market failures, but Texas is different than Massachusetts, and there'll never be a coast-to-coast housing crisis. Well, he didn't understand there was a national housing market. The world had changed. We were not dealing with little SNLs anymore, lending, you know, in a 10-block area in New York City. This was a national market, and national lending practices led to a national crisis.
Do you think, knowing what he knows now, that Alan Greenspan would have either not lowered rates as dramatically after 2001 and been more tighter on regulation in the mortgage market during that period, or at the very least raised them faster and kept them higher after that initial cut?
Well, I think the really important point in your question is regulation. So one of the key points I think is ill understood, and I really tried to explain this in my book, is the interplay between monetary policy and financial regulation, bank and non-bank. You know, it's, people think about banks and huge banks and J.P. Morgan with great big buildings on Park Avenue. Actually, by financial assets, the United States non-banks have more financial assets than banks. So this is not a financial system controlled
by banks.
The
shadow banking market.
Exactly. Well, except it's not so shadow. It's kind of out there. Yeah. And that is, was particularly true in housing, going back to 2003 through 2008 in that crash, where you had a huge growth of non-bank lenders, subprime lenders. They were called democratizing mortgage finance, but actually many of their practices were not only very high risk, but even predatory, as we saw. And they had a government system, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Federal Housing Administration, creating essentially a no-risk system for high-risk lenders because those government agencies bought the mortgages directly or through mortgage-backed securities that very speculative, often unscrupulous mortgage lenders originated. And we saw that. I testified in 2003 that this was going to be a dangerous proposition and told Congress that. We worked hard in my firm trying to identify the causes of the housing crisis at the time and bring them to policymakers' attention. But there was a strong view, both from the leftover from the Clinton administration and in the George W., was that light-touch regulation. This is the free market. That we can't have a national housing crisis, therefore this is generating economic growth. And monetary policy, I think, was less important than regulatory policy, although the two, again, fed off of each other.
That you said monetary policy was less important than regulatory policy.
In terms of driving up the housing boom, the ultra-low rates played a role. I mean, again, both monetary and regulatory policy interact. But had the rules been tighter and borrower protections been better and the government-sponsored enterprises less profit focused and more stability minded, I don't think we would have had the crisis.
How much of a role did the sort of Fed put the what would have been at that time, I guess, you know, almost two decades of leadership under Alan Greenspan, where the market believed and he certainly stoked this idea that he and I guess, well, you know, the cover story of Time magazine in 1999, when was it? or 1998, Committee to Save the World with him and then Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers, or Rubin was Treasury Secretary. Lawrence Summers, I guess, then was Deputy Secretary. Regardless, this idea that we can just go and take reckless amounts of risk because the Fed's got our back. It's yes. intangible and difficult to quantify, but I often wonder if that's not actually more important than both. That was not more important than both regulation and interest rate policy.
It's huge. And that's why in my book, I talk a lot about the Greenspan. They call the so-called Greenspan put.
Yeah.
And that the market will never drop. And I say there's been a Greenspan put, a Bernanke put, a Yellen put. Now we have a Powell put.
Well, people forget. I mean, they used to, CNBC used to have the briefcase indicator. They used to look at Alan Greenspan's briefcase when he used to go into work to see and to, if it was bigger at an FOMC meeting that somehow hinted at something. You know, I mean, crazy.
No, but still true. I mean, the everybody listens. You just watch the financial press. Every utterance from every Federal Reserve Bank president, from every Federal Reserve Bank governor, from every Federal Reserve Bank janitor, every Federal Reserve Bank official has an immediate impact on the market. It determines the market because the markets are operating knowing, again, that put exists. So as long as they operate within the parameters of what they think the Fed is going to do, they can't lose. And they haven't.
So let's go back to two things, because you actually highlight them in the book, though we talked about a little bit about statistics, which is very important because that's sort of that's the sensorium through which the Federal Reserve perceives the world, perceives the market upon which it acts. But you really make a point to emphasize both the transmission mechanism of monetary policy from the supply side and then the demand side of that equation, which is the marginal propensity to consume or lack thereof of the middle class and the reliance on that assumption, models that in many ways are informed from the period of the 1970s, to actually stimulate the economy. So let's take each of those in turn with respect to the banking system, because, I mean, we saw this in the recent pandemic crisis. The Fed has now set up liquidity facilities directly purchasing corporate bonds. You know, it's only a matter of time, in my view, before they start purchasing indices and God forbid, individual stocks. Can you walk me through both of these, beginning first with the transmission mechanism on the supply side?
That's a lot, Dimitri. There's a lot in there, but I think the key is these facilities, because the Fed's understanding of the economy is through the financial markets. And so the view is if you save the financial markets, you save the economy. And certainly financial crashes are not good for the economy. That's why central banks exist with their longstanding discount window authority to lend during liquidity crises. But the problem with these market rescues, the so-called puts, is that it's very hard to determine, and often, in fact, the Fed steps in when there are solvency crises as well. The banking system was rescued, AIG was rescued, Fannie and Freddie, a lot of insolvent entities were rescued in 2008. That was a different form of put. And then in 2020, as you say, we rescued everything up to and including the junk bond market. Wild risks, you know, corporate bonds for companies with no earnings were selling at, you know, premium prices. And when the COVID hit and everybody said, oh my God, the real economy might suffer, the Fed stepped in and rescued pretty much anyone across the financial system. And, you know, the markets had a few bad days, and then they took back off again, even as unemployment climbed to record numbers. And the view that you can, I think what's fundamentally wrong with the market put and the so-called moral hazard, i.e. you can never lose psychology that develops, is that any American who's not in the market, which is in terms of real wealth, virtually all Americans, loses. The markets enrich wealthier households. I know a lot of Americans have 401k plans, and it's very important. But, you know, the top 1% has 53% of American financial assets. The top 10% has 88% of the assets. It's not shared wealth. And when you have the kind of debt that most households had going into 2020, the Fed rescued the financial market and households were put at grave risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so I have a few thoughts here. One, the reason I brought up the corporate bond market is for the same reason that I would mention the hiccups that we saw in the repo market with Treasury collateral, because both of those reflect regulatory changes on the banking side, which have distorted and sent, for example, in the corporate bond market, made the corporate bond market a more important funding mechanism or platform for corporates than it was prior to 2008. That speaks to your point about regulation. I also think another thing that comes to mind, which is so interesting, is how interest rate policy and monetary policy and what they call financial repression has turned index investing into basically the equivalent of a savings vehicle. And in many ways has destabilized, created a lot of instability, underlying instability in financial markets, because the way in which people view their investments is no longer as a speculation. Is certainly when you're investing in an index, you're told that this is basically the equivalent of savings. It's how you generate yield. In other words, people still need yield, and they are willing to do increasingly insane things in order to get it.
Oh, yeah. That's right. And the wealthier you are, the more you can manage your portfolio and balance it. And but you see, and look at what happened in the GameStop case. Most of these people were not wealthy. They were gambling because it was their only way to save.
Right.
Or so they thought.
Right. I mean, that I'm curious to get your views on that, because that has become, I think, one of the most important logical leaps that I think a lot of people fail to make, which millennials have made, which actually explain, I use millennials in particular here because they are in some ways the most disenfranchised generation in 100 years, but it explains behavior that would otherwise seem illogical because of the fact that costs, the cost of tuition, student loans, housing, etc., have gone up so much that in order to actually make a dent, you can't save your way to prosperity. You have to gamble your way to prosperity. And I wonder, do you think at all about how monetary policy certainly has contributed to this, but overall, how this phenomenon has damaged what is supposed to be the most vital generation in America today, which are millennials, and the generation which is going to the point about that we started with this conversation about political risk, that is set to take power in this new decade, and how that's going to shape policy in the 2020s?
These are great, great, again, really hard, but great questions. And I do think a lot about them. There's a lot in the book on exactly these questions. The inability to save and what that does to both financial markets in terms of creating asset bubbles, Bitcoin, speculative stocks, housing prices even, you know, with the impact of the pandemic. There is a lot of debate about whether housing prices have become a new bubble back, as we saw over a decade ago. But the Fed's view of price stability, as you said, how the cost of being middle class has gone up enormously. And yet the Fed thinks there's price stability. Well, there may be in the measures it looks at, but not in terms of what it costs to try to run a household, have kids. Now, with wage growth, middle class wage growth in 2019 was the same in real terms as it was in 2001. And with all those cost increases, now most millennial households have two wage earners. People often are working more than two jobs. They're working more hours. And that means they need childcare. You know, it's astonishing when you think we have a middle class. Well, the people who fall into the middle of the income spectrum, 24% of the quote middle class in 2019 skipped medical payments because they couldn't afford them. So that's when you think about how will people make decisions? Well, I would be very angry.
I think we've seen that.
Yeah. It's not fair. It isn't fair.
Yeah. Well, that goes to the point about, we didn't really talk about it explicitly. It's something that I talked about in an episode with Katharina Pistor, which has to do with how regulations actually shape the playing field. Regulations and regulatory choices. I mean, policy actually has a huge impact on wealth distribution without even taking into account redistributive policies through taxation.
Absolutely. The reason I called the book Engine of Inequality is that if you look at Thomas Piketty's book on capitalism and inequality, what he shows really clearly is that inequality is cumulative. The richer you are, the richer you get, the poorer you are, the poorer you get, and you hollow out the middle class by wealth moving up and out of all but the richest households, unless policy intervenes. And that policy can be, his focus is on inheritance taxes and wealth taxes. Mine is on monetary and regulatory policy. There are certainly others like education policy, the cost of college and student debt. Each of them plays an important role. But if you don't have equitable policy, you will have cumulative economic inequality because of the power of that engine.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. As you were saying that, I have oftentimes, certainly for episodes like this, I go into cartoonstock.com and I buy cartoons and I put them into the rundown. And there's this one here with a hot dog vendor, and he's priced hot dogs at 25 cents. And there are two bankers walking by, and the guy goes, "I told you the Fed should have tightened." but that's a little side note. So you mentioned Bitcoin, and you talk a little bit about central bank digital currencies in the book. One, what is your view on CBDCs? And two, how would monetary policy work in a world like that where money is going directly into people's wallets without necessarily having to enter the banking system?
You know, you think about what is money, and money used to be goats and chickens, and I have a chapter about this in my book, and we all know now, for most of us, money is digits along with some cash. Interestingly, the lower income you have, middle, moderate, lower income, the more cash you use. So everybody says this is going to be a cashless society. Well, you know, maybe up where I live in Washington, D.C., but not for most American households. But that's what cash is. We have, quote, token cash, which is fiat currency, dollars and coins, physical. And then we have the digits that are in our bank accounts that we never see. You know, you get your paycheck on not in coins or dollars. It's just a statement, dollars that are in an account. So the revolution of digital money is like the revolution of digital everything else, which is that why not create new forms of money that aren't fiat currency, aren't the money the Fed creates, that are money, whether Facebook creates it or Bitcoins create it, that we just all choose to use. They're faster. For example, the current payment system is very slow. And in Bitcoin's case, you can get rich as opposed to dollars, and you put the dollars in the bank. Back to what we were talking about, you lose money. If you put your dollars into Bitcoins, you think you're going to make money. So you have money that isn't money in the sense of what we think of money. Do you want to get paid in Bitcoins? Can you go buy that hot dog in Bitcoins? Could you go buy a car?
Certainly not at 25 cents.
No, exactly. But what's money? Money is for, it's a medium of exchange so that you get paid in it and then you buy things in it. I can sell you a car and you give me money. It's a medium of exchange that I'm willing to accept. And then I take the dollars you give me and I go buy a house. The medium of exchange is stable across all these transactions. And money is a store of value. That's what we expect it to be. If I put it in the bank, if I put $100 in the bank, I get $100 back. Digital money is pushing at all of those concepts of money. But because the system is so digital, it certainly is, I think, increasingly true that there will be less and less cash, less and less token currency. And we're going to need a faster, better digital currency to support a payment system. So the key when you talk about central bank digital currency is, does the Fed create that digital currency, basically an electronic dollar? And if it does that, how does that digital dollar, which is what members of Congress now are talking about, move through the financial system? Congressional Democrats are talking about creating Fed accounts in which you would deposit your pay at the Fed, not at the bank. in the Fed accounts, then you would write checks, the equivalent of checks, or on your clicks, taps, transactions against that Fed account into the payment system, which the Federal Reserve now largely controls. That's one option. It's similar to our system right now, but it's different in that the Fed would become basically the national, not just the central bank, but the national bank as well for all of our accounts.
Why do you think that Western central banks have been so late to the game on this one?
First of all, they're not exactly innovative. Secondly, any institution that are used to being as powerful as they are haven't thought that anyone could challenge their hegemony. Secondly, I think things have changed really, really fast. I mean, 2-3 years ago, we wouldn't be talking about this way because the digital currencies were very marginal. What really changed the debate was Facebook's proposal in 2019 to create Libra, its own digital currency. And when you have a company with, I think, 3.5 billion customers, all of a sudden, true banks said, well, maybe we're not as important as we thought. We have competition.
Yeah, that was a bit of a shock to the system at the time.
And it still is. It really shook up the concept of currency and the concept of central banking and the concept of payment systems.
How familiar are you with stablecoins?
Reasonably.
We did an episode with Rowan Gray, who was one of the prime authors of the Stable Act. And he actually made an interesting point about how, in a way that I hadn't really thought about, which was that stablecoins effectively piggyback off of the stability created by the national currency, in this case, the dollar. And in that way, they effectively operate as promissory notes made by private entities that at the limit are not able to actually honor those pledges. And that they would effectively, if a situation like Facebook's Libra were to grow and scale in order to service the U.S. economy, that it would quickly become too big to fail in the deepest sense of the word, in a way that we really haven't been familiar with in the past, and that that simply would be really bad policy, and that the U.S. should legislate against that. I'm curious what your view is on that.
I agree with that in broad terms. I mean, the idea of a, quote, the reason people are, Bitcoin isn't a stable coin. Bitcoin is bits, and you just trade in and out of it through the various Bitcoin mining.
Definitely not stable.
No. And the idea that Facebook came up with stablecoin is that you have a Libra, now they're calling it DM, that's stable like a dollar because it's based on a basket of currencies. And then there are a lot of new, Wyoming is chartering cryptocurrency, stablecoin banks and things like that. And the idea is, again, that you have this thing, this token, this currency that is based on a basket of assets or currencies. But Facebook has never made clear what kind of currencies it will have in there. And currency values change. There's a huge foreign exchange market. The price goes up, the price goes down. Will Facebook be trading in these stable in the currencies in its basket? Who makes the money when it trades in the basket? What if there is there going to be enough in the basket? The payment system is run through the Fed, through banks, because banks hold, as I said before, reserves, and banks have capital requirements, and banks are highly regulated. So that when you put your money into a checking account and you go to write a check, you don't really worry that the $100 you put in is still there, or maybe it's $85 because something happened overnight. Now, we really need a regimen for stablecoins that ensures that that basket of currencies is put only into sterile assets, i.e. assets that the Facebook can't touch, that are always going to be there and are easily liquid to ensure payment system finality. It's a very risky proposition if that basket backing the stablecoin is, as it currently is constructed in many cases, just something else cool that the offerer of the stablecoin gets to make money with.
Yeah, it's a bit of a complicated situation also because, again, central banks have been late to the game. And so a lot
That's right.
These private sector players are filling a market need. Now, there's a huge speculative component of it, tons of fraud. I don't mean specifically in stablecoins. I mean across the entire industry. But in some ways, they're responding in a way that central banks have not. And while I'm sympathetic to the arguments put forward by Rowan, and I think there's actually a lot of merit to it, and I do think that a stablecoin at scale would be too big to fail, then that would be very dangerous and unfair for those of us that would have to bail it out. At the same time, you know, Janet Yellen recently, it was like a month ago, not even a month ago, where she said that they're beginning to think about central bank digital currencies. I mean, I think that literally is what she said. And I find that stunning. I find that stunning in the way similar to how I'm stunned that Federal Reserve policy officials and people in government couldn't understand that the Fed was creating actually a driver in inequality. I mean, your thesis to me is absolute common sense. And it's something that I've personally understood for a very long time.
Great.
You know, it's plainly obvious simply in the levitation of asset prices and recognizing who owns assets. I mean, it's commonsensical. So I find it similarly tone deaf. I want to ask you one more question, Karen, and then I'm going to move us into the overtime. We'll continue this conversation and get into solutions.
Okay.
And that question has to do with the fact that that the Federal Reserve's liability, which is the U.S. dollar, is not a national currency. I mean, it's a national currency, but it's the global reserve currency. And of course, we know that whenever there's a large liquidity drawdown in U.S. financial markets or globally, the Fed rushes in to set up swap lines. Why? Because so much credit and leverage is generated in dollars outside of the U.S. financial system. And therefore, Fed policy and monetary policy in the U.S. isn't just a domestic affair. It has impact on the globe. And of course, the globe comes back and impacts the U.S. So how much can the Fed really afford to focus solely on America's economy? Because I think in your book, it almost seems as though you exclude the rest of the world when you think about, or you have in your assumptions. How much can it afford to focus on America's economy when thinking about monetary policy, considering how integrated the world is and how dependent the global economy is on the U.S. dollar?
Well, I focused on the U.S. because there are only so many pages I could write in one book. And my real call is what you said before, maybe common sense, but a lot of people didn't understand how monetary policy, particularly through driving up asset prices and ultra-low rates and the role of the Fed's huge portfolio, that's very controversial. The Fed strongly disagrees with what's in my book. They say economic inequality is solely the fault of fiscal policy, tax policy, and they're not doing anything that anybody could argue with. So I really felt I needed to spend time in the book laying out all of what you say to try, most importantly, to get the Fed to change, because this country cannot take continuing economic inequality. Again, the political instability, the human cost. Look at what happened in COVID and how damaging it was to communities of color and low-income households. We just can't keep doing this.
Yeah,
that's wrong. Now, the Fed is really conscious of its impact as the reserve currency. Every time it did this in 2008, it did it again last year in 2020. It sets up dollar swap facilities to help other central banks deal with the impact of financial instability. And it is really aware of how U.S. low rates create high-risk emerging debt markets and so forth. We're related in the sense that problems, as we saw in 2011, problems in Greece can all of a sudden mean problems in the United States in terms of financial stability. But Fed policy is first and foremost about domestic economic growth, prosperity, and financial stability. If we start there, I think the rest of these other issues will follow in good order.
So I'm going to move us into the overtime, Karen. In the overtime, I want to discuss, one, how the Fed can change the measuring sticks that it uses to determine the efficacy of its policy, whether we're talking about measuring employment, whether we're talking about measuring inflation. I also want to discuss political instability, because some of your solutions I want to understand better, because I kind of disagree with some of the outcomes that I think would be generated from them. And that's because I think there are political dynamics at play with some of the things you suggest. While I would love to live in the world that you describe in the book, let's see if you can help me get there.
Sure.
I also would love to get your projections, not your forecasts, but when we're talking about things like balance sheet growth, I think one area where I myself have been surprised, I will acknowledge this. If you had told me in 2008 that the Fed was going to move from a $900 billion balance sheet to what is it, like $10 trillion today, some enormous number. I don't even know off the top of my head what it is.
It's right now, as we speak, it's 7.4 trillion, yeah, heading to 10.
Yeah,
heading to 10.
It feels like 10. It feels like 20.
Yep, it's a lot.
I wouldn't have believed you that we would have been able to do that without generating inflation. And I was aware of Japan's case. But at the time, I think when I had thought about the case of Japan and they were finishing up their second lost decade at that time, I saw Japan as being fundamentally different. And the reasons that Japan wasn't able to generate that the consumer price inflation, I thought was different. But I was wrong on that. So I'm curious to hear your view on how long you think the Fed can continue along its current trajectory, how big the balance sheet can get, and what it's going to try to buy before it can actually finally break markets. For anyone who is new to the program, Hidden Forces is listener supported. We don't accept advertisers or commercial sponsors. The entire show is funded from top to bottom by listeners like you. If you want access to the second part of my conversation with Karen, as well as the transcripts and rundowns to this episode and every other episode we've ever done, head over to hiddenforces.io to check out our episode library or subscribe directly through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. There's also a link in the summary page to this episode with instructions on how to connect the overtime feed to your phone so that you can listen to these extra discussions just like you listen to the regular podcast. Karen, stick around. We're going to move the rest of our conversation into the subscriber overtime.
Sure.
Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.